Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Market moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Good Friday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Leslie Picker and Mike Santoli, live at Post 9 of the New York Stock Exchange. Cramer and David Faber have the morning off. Kicking off Q3, kind of how we left Q2. Futures are red. More deflationary signals from the likes of Micron has the two-year yield at 2.82, down 60 basis points in just 10 days. 10-year 2.89. Our roadmap begins with tech's belt tightening. Facebook parent Meta, the latest name to cut company talent. As Zuckerberg warns, this might be one of the worst downturns that we've seen in recent history.
Plus, Kohl's ending talks to sell its business, sending shares tanking nearly 20% in pre-market. We've got the details.
And Micron under pressure despite beating on earnings as the CEO warns of weakening consumer demand.
Let's start with the markets as we look to bounce back a little bit after the S&P posts its worst first half since 1970, guys. From a micro corporate standpoint, Mike, it was Nike, then Bed Bath, then RH. And now it's Micron and to a lesser extent Kohl's today.
Yes. And they are, in a sense, the companies are confirming a lot of the apprehension that we've seen in the market. They are ratifying what's happened to valuations to some degree and saying that the markets in general, as you mentioned, the two-year yield is pivoting toward being much more concerned about the magnitude of a slowdown and dipping into recession, especially in a week when, you know, Fed Chair Jay Powell says things that could be implied. It could be inferred as meaning that a recession is kind of the feature and not the bug of the tightening campaign. And I'm not saying that's really true. They're not trying to do that. But coming with fiscal contraction and all the rest, the side effects of the inflation medicine are having a pretty significant impact. Big question is, how much has the market already figured that out? Okay. The average stock down 30% from its high in the S&P. It's been cut in half in the NASDAQ. Valuations have rationalized to some degree. You know, Micron would be an interesting example of this, right? Stock's down 40% going into this number. Absolutely massive down revenue guidance for the coming quarter. And stock's going to be down a bit, but not dramatically. So we'll see if that can be something of a template for how we kind of digest what's probably going to be a messy earnings season.
Goldman would argue that the market hasn't actually figured it out. They have a new note out saying that the renewed sell-off in equity markets is still high because investors are still only pricing in a mild recession. And then you had that Michael Burry tweet of Big Short fame where he basically is saying that the sell-off is only halfway over and that we've seen a compression in multiples, but we haven't seen it in earnings. And so, you know, as we look ahead for the next week or so, we've got probably some pretty tepid trading volumes as we go into earnings season, though those will ramp up and we will start to get some news and get a better sense of what happened during the second quarter.
Yeah, maybe halfway there, as Burry says. And with that, yesterday we had Atlanta Fed track Q2 GDP negative. Goldman cuts to 1.9. B of A cuts to 1.5. And then the break evens, Mike.
Yeah.
5-year break even, lowest since October. 10-year lowest since September. Can we start to think about a classic downturn and not a stagflationary downturn in that case?
I think so. And I think there's also a big question about what the character of a downturn might be. Meaning, will it have the full effect on unemployment that a typical recession has had? We had such a tight labor market. We have theoretically excess job openings. You don't have the consumer balance sheet stress in the same position. Obviously, what the market's struggling with is, you know, the bond market can implicitly declare victory on it, on the inflation, and say it's peaked and it's going to be trending lower, even if it's because of a downtrend. The Fed can't act as if it's done the job
right.
yet.
Well, the moment they unwind all their good work.
Right. Or it's just going to be seen as too late to actually rescue what growth is looking like. So, again, I look at a Michael Burry tweet like that. And first of all, is that not becoming consensus? Valuations are down, but wait for the earnings revisions low. I mean, that's what people are just geared for right now. I think it's becoming what the mantra is. We've heard it on our air all week. Now, the way it works is the valuation's going down is the market's way of saying we think earnings are coming in lower. It's not right. because they've decided the fair value is that much lower. So I think that there's a lot of play in here. It's very difficult to say, yep, we've reached that moment. We've already discounted, you know, the worst or the most plausible scenario. So it's a tough one. I could say, you know, sentiment is where it probably has to be. Even if it's not panicky, it's mostly you got to wrung a lot of optimism out of the system. Credit's a little bit of an issue now because the credit markets are acting like this macro picture is getting a little more stressful.
Right. Well, maybe we can touch on some high yield and IG names later on in the hour. GM is a big story, was halted a few moments ago. You heard the news from Phil LeBeau. Kind of has some dovetailing effect with the Micron news. Morning, Phil.
Good morning, Carl. And what General Motors is saying is that the chip crisis, we knew that it was going to be hurting deliveries in the second quarter to a certain extent with everybody. But General Motors is saying they have 95,000 vehicles that they've built that they are ready to ship to dealers. I'm imagining that most of these have already been pre-ordered, pre-sold essentially to different people, but they don't have the chips necessary in order to finish the vehicle completely so that they can deliver it to the dealer. The significance here is that in the auto industry, it is not a sale. You do not book revenue until you actually deliver a vehicle to a dealership. So that's 95,000 vehicles in sales, in revenue that General Motors could not realize or will not be able to realize in the second quarter. Nonetheless, the company expects to deliver them by the end of the year. They expect to have the same full year earnings that they had previously issued as guidance. So that does not change. But in terms of the Q2 sales and deliveries, there's the impact there in terms of those 95,000 vehicles. But overall, sales down 15%. The estimate, according to Edmunds, was for sales to be down 17%. So a little bit better. But keep in mind, Carl, nobody's going to get excited about sales being down 15% when the street was expecting a decline of 17%. Bottom line is they continue to be constricted in terms of production because of chips. There's still far more demand than there is supply of new vehicles.
Right. As for Tesla, Phil, it's actually going to open higher this morning. We've had delivery numbers cut this week by Citi, Mizuho, Deutsche, Webbush. And with some of these NIOs and XPengs coming in, is there a sense that maybe they can hit the mark?
Well, I think that everybody is looking at Tesla and they're saying, take away the second quarter. China was a disaster in terms of not for Tesla, but they had the lockdowns in Shanghai. So you have to bring down the numbers dramatically for Tesla. They have started to ramp up production again. The NIO and the XPeng, Carl, the thing to keep in mind with those is those stocks move dramatically on the slightest bit of news out of China. But look at the volume that they have in China right now relative to Tesla. Doesn't mean they can't catch up, and I know there are some who believe that they will have a portfolio at NIO that ultimately could catch Tesla, but right now it's really, really low volume relative to Tesla.
Yep, that's important to keep in mind. Phil, a ton on your beat today. We'll talk soon, I imagine. That's our Phil LeBeau on GM. Let's turn to Meta this morning, the Facebook parent, the latest tech company to cut its hiring plans. According to this report from Reuters, in an employee Q&A, Zuckerberg warned it might be, quote, one of the worst downturns we've seen in recent history. He went on to say, quote, realistically, there are probably a bunch of people at the company who shouldn't be here. And they're, according to Reuters, looking at a engineer hiring target now in the 6,000 to 7,000 range, whereas they came into the year, Leslie, more like 10,000.
Yeah, the engineering part of this is really remarkable because engineering talent has been so difficult to find in Silicon Valley. You often have to pay up for that. Stock-based compensation, though, if you look at a company like Meta or a lot of its big tech peers, stock prices have fallen so much that in order to be competitive, it's much more difficult. But when you start to kind of think about lower forecasts for your engineering talent, that is an indication that they are taking this seriously. They are taking the potential for a downturn seriously. And it begs the question, which of their big tech peers might follow?
Truist today names it one of their best ideas. You know, Reuters had a similar story yesterday about Comcast, our parent, and the upfront, according to a source calling it the best upfront commitment since Comcast acquired NBC. So it does make you wonder whether the ad market's holding in firmer than Zuckerberg seems to be suggesting.
Yes. I mean, I think the economy and I think the general feeling around the fact that there's a retrenchment going on gives a company like Meta the permission, essentially, to say we're no longer in rapid growth mode. We're no longer in hoarding talent mode. We have a platform that investors love because it's just automatic. It's like the Google search box. And, you know, why do we need tens of thousands of people doing things around it? I'm not saying that's the correct assumption, but that's the way the market would love for these companies to think about themselves. And now that the economy is doing what it's doing, there you can say, well, ad demand softening up, maybe we have to just pull in our sights for how much growth is going to be. And you try to just help the margins out along the way.
We saw that a little bit with Elon Musk and Tesla as well, too, where they're kind of almost floating this idea of a natural attrition, this idea, you know, if you don't want to come into the office, you can go find employment elsewhere. I mean, it seems like tech and some of these higher growth companies or higher growth of the past are looking for ways to trim costs now. You know, potentially we'll see more of a fallout from that later this year.
Laying off without laying off,
exactly.
For example. Yeah.
72,000 employees at Meta at this point right now.
Wow.
And it's a lot.
Sheryl Sandberg is not one of them.
That's right. She's
or soon won't be one of them.
Not, yeah.
When you look at sectors, I mean, there's been a lot of obviously retrospection about Q2, Mike, but discretionary and comm services were the worst. The least bad were staples and utilities and energy, obviously. Is there a sense of a mean reversion on some of these sectors going into Q3?
You know, it's so far it's been painful to try to anticipate that moment when we said enough is enough on this defensive trade. So far, the leadership still is very classically defensive and very boring. And that's been the rule. Pharma, quietly, we don't talk about big pharma. It's cheap, it's value, it's steady. Insurance within financials has worked actually pretty well. That's kind of a direct yield play and things like that. They can actually make money on their bonds in terms of holding to maturity. So I think that there are right now, you can say it's gone pretty far. Like I was looking at the equal weight of consumer discretionary forward multiple. It's gone from 28 to 14 in about 14, 15 months. Consumer staples, rock steady, is now a big premium to consumer discretion. That's equal weight. So that doesn't account really for Amazon and Tesla taking over so much of it. Is that enough? Is that cheap? Is that just fair value? Do these swings stop in the middle at fair value, or do they have to overshoot? And that's where we are, I think, at the moment. You know, microcaps have really fallen behind in terms of even relative to small caps. So the message of the market is, you know, we're backing away from risk. We're not embracing it. We think it's not the moment to get cyclical again. You know, I think you could say a lot of the work has been done, but you never know if it's fully there.
Is there anything to be made of kind of historical precedent? I guess there are two instances, 2 years, where the first half has declined more than what we saw this year in 62 and 1970, in which case during the second half of the year, there were massive rebounds.
Yeah.
The second 6 months of 62 rising 15%, the second 6 months of 70 rising 27%. Is there anything we can glean from that? Just looking kind of to hold on to some dose of optimism for the second half of the year.
I think you can say, first of all, small sample size, as anybody would grant. I think what you could say is markets never just go down in a straight line. And, you know, they tend to have a little bit of recovery, certainly when the calendar gets more friendly later in the year. 1962 has always been a very interesting example. We've talked with Art Cashin about it. It was a non-recessionary bear market. I mean, there was like a lot of economic static going on, but that was one that I think people were hopeful about. Also, the peak was right at the start of the year, as it was this year. 1970, as I said yesterday, we were down for a year before we got into that year, and that was pretty much a kind of grinding bear market. So I don't know if I want to hinge it on, well, history says we're going up in the second half, except to say that there will be relief along the way, most likely, as we figure out that either the slowdown is not coming through as much as we thought, or the Fed is going to be forced to turn friendlier again, or, you know, we've just kind of discounted stuff.
Yeah, or as Stovall suggested this morning, maybe the midterms mean the relief comes later than the second half.
That's what the textbook says as well. Recent midterm years haven't adhered that well to it, but could be.
After the break, we're going to hit some of the cruise lines. What a week. The biggest laggards on the S&P for the quarter, Royal Caribbean, Carnival, Norwegian, all down around 50% or more in that three-month period. We'll get to this downgrade on FedEx. We'll talk some Kohl's, Macau, some of the fallout on Micron for phones and PCs and data centers. As for the 10-year, 287, and the long bond, just 9 basis points above 3. A lot more Squawk on the Street is straight ahead.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Cruise stocks sinking, among the worst quarter performers as we head into the second half of the year. Joining us with his outlook for the sector, Truist analyst Patrick Scholes. Patrick, good to have you here this morning. Yeah, the travel trade really did reverse recently. Even things like hotels, in addition to airlines and cruise lines, people worried about just sort of this kind of concentrated demand maybe going into the summer for bookings and then falling off. Does that make sense? Do you think that's going to actually come through in terms of these companies' results?
Well, as far as the overall travel sector, certainly I would say there's less a concern about hotels and more of a concern about cruise lines. Overall, obviously leisure extremely strong for the summer. For the fall, for hotels, maybe a little bit of a slowdown as we get more into the business travel season. Looking at the back half of the year, as far as things like hotel group bookings, it still remains very solid.
Well, the cruise lines, obviously pricing has perhaps been an issue. And of course, capital structures are an issue. I mean, what they had to do to stay in business for a while, raising a lot of debt and selling more shares, keeps them in a tough position. What's your outlook right now among, let's say, the three big ones?
Yeah, certainly it's it's been challenging. It's going to be challenging for all of them. And really, the issues boil down to you just have a ton of capacity out there, and just not enough pricing power to at least fill the ships at attractive pricing in light of oil prices going up, food prices going up. I remain very concerned about the group, especially in light of major refinancings coming up that are for example, Royal Caribbean has $8 billion of debt coming up over the next year and a half. So certainly, at this point, I can't recommend any of them. And I don't have buy ratings on any of them. In fact, a sell rating on Carnival.
Yeah, presumably a much higher refinancing rate for them. Just looking in terms of potential catalysts for this group, what happens if vaccination and COVID testing requirements do get dropped? Is that a positive for cruise stocks, or is that a potential negative as people just fear being on a cruise ship and getting sick because there's less precaution?
Yeah, those would be huge positives, especially dropping the vaccination requirement. Unfortunately, it does not seem that it's going to be happening this year. If there's a little bit of luck, it might happen somewhere, perhaps middle of next year. But that's another year of just burning cash. So, yes, if that were to happen, it would clearly be a positive. However, I'm not expecting it to happen. Not going to happen this year.
Patrick, in times past, cruise lines would sort of be positioned as the value option in tougher consumer times. Is that going to be of any help to them if, in fact, we do have a little more concern about, spending in the second half of the year?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Even today, they are an exceptional value in relation to very expensive land-based vacation options at hotels. But again, the challenge is, demand just took a huge hit, and you're just coming back from such a low base. It's going to be hard to get enough demand in relation to, sort of where we're starting and in relation to having next year 25% more rooms or berths to sell versus 2019. It's just a ton of supply out there. I mean, it's going to luck is really going to have to turn for these folks, and demand is really going to have to pick up from here on out for these companies.
Yeah, does not look like a clear path. Patrick, thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk to Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones. Some football, but mostly about his big bet on nat gas, more than doubling his billion-dollar investment as that commodity is coming off a drubbing yesterday. Take a look at futures here as we kick off the month of July, Q3, and the second half. More Squawk on the Street when we return.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
Still to come, we'll talk more some more Micron shares sliding down almost 4% after the results, the guidance, the CapEx cut, the inventory chatter, the qualitative color on PCs and smartphones and data center. Sanjay Mehrotra is going to join us exclusively on Tuesday after the long weekend on this hour, 9:40 a.m. In the meantime, futures remain red. Opening bell in just about 5.5 minutes. Take a look at Micron shares sliding post results, warning about weakening consumer demand in smartphone sales and PCs. Here is Sanjay Mehrotra talking about the issue on yesterday's call.
These consumer markets have been impacted by the weakness in consumer spending in China, the Russia-Ukraine war, and rising inflation around the world. COVID-19 control measures in China have exacerbated supply chain challenges for some customers, and the macroeconomic environment is also creating some caution amongst certain customers. Several customers, primarily in PC and smartphone, are adjusting their inventories, and we expect these adjustments to take place mostly in the second half of calendar 2022.
By the way, CEO, as we said, is going to join us on Tuesday in this hour, 9 a.m. Eastern time. 53.12 this morning, Leslie, is going to take out the low for the year and take you back to the fall of 2020.
Yeah, you had a downgrade from B of A as well, saying that fundamental growth recovery could be well into 23 for this stock. So looking pretty far out for some sort of growth picture to hit. At least Micron. I'm curious, Mike, your take on how much we can extrapolate from his comments about consumer weakness. Yeah. And it's important to note that's global consumer weakness, because
sure,
we talk all the time about how it's so strong here in the U.S. But globally, the picture looks quite different.
For sure.
How much we can extrapolate that to the rest of the chip sector?
I mean, you absolutely can in the areas that were most affected. So I think if I'm looking at the market reaction here, again, this is a massive revenue miss on guidance.
$2 billion miss.
It's $2 billion. So the point is you have to kind of scale that with how the stock is reacting after having already been down 43%. So the areas of most weakness were the areas where we kind of knew were going to be weak. Now, maybe they're weaker than we anticipated. But it shows you that the interplay between what the market's already been kind of bracing for and the actual news, you know, it doesn't always overlap in time. So the stock was looking like it was 6x earnings before the report. No, guess what? We're going to have to go down. B of A saying it's $7 a share next year. It's more like 8x earnings. But meanwhile, B of A has a $62 price target on our neutral.
Which is so a 12% upside.
Again, it's already done a lot of the pain's been felt to a large degree in the stock. Anyway.
Let's get this opening bell out of the way, and then we'll resume the Micron discussion. At the big board, it is Deloitte celebrating its cloud-based audit technology platform. And at the NASDAQ, it's 374 Water, a sustainable waste management company, as we officially get Q3 underway. Your point, Mike, about the damage that's already been done is exactly what Cramer's saying on his day off on Twitter. Try as they may, The analyst couldn't get Sanjay to say there was data center weakness, only low-end cell phone and all PC. Down huge already. He says anything can go lower in this market. Although they did say on data center, we're seeing some enterprise OEMs wanting to pare back their memory and storage inventory due to non-memory component shortages and macro concerns. But your point about the B of A call today, they go to 62.
Right.
It's a lot about the fallout of KLA 10 Core.
Yes.
And AMAT and some of those other names, because the CapEx is going to decline.
That's very true. And so there is an echo effect right there. And there's also that sense, you know, we've seen peak cycle, B of A saying, you know, and implicitly the market saying, you're going to have to wait. I mean, it's, you know, you mentioned 2023. Well, it's less than half a year away at this point. So maybe that's not outside of the market's time horizon. But yeah, it obviously we're in this kind of period where you're downscaling expectations for what the growth is going to look like. Okay. Semis, certainly not a leadership group as they had been before. They've not been given the green light for the risk takers for a while. But again, down 40% is 40% off, you know, pretty high number.
Of course, you contrast that with some of the supply challenges of last year. Now it seems like the issue is more on the demand side of the equation, that they have finally caught up on the supply side. And of course, as Carl mentioned, there's been just this massive reversion.
From shortages to gluts in the blink of an eye. And the one thing we haven't yet mentioned is McConnell yesterday threatening to hold up the CHIPS Act because of the partisan Schumer-Manchin hand-holding on a potential reconciliation bill. That's going to be important, too, if we can't, if we are going to sacrifice sort of onshoring production because of that. That's going to affect the industry as well.
A longer-term issue for sure. I guess it'll affect, you know, psychology and really, you know, kind of Intel's big bet on domestic manufacturing, which is mostly their own money. But they obviously wanted the backing and the help and the clearances of this bill. We'll see. It seems like it's a bargaining chip at this point, so to speak. You know, we'll see what that means, because we don't really even know what we're talking about in terms of, you know, the maneuverings on the reconciliation stuff, how strong a push that is.
Right. Although it is something that Gary Cohn, former National Economic Council director, talked about with Jim last night. Take a listen to this.
The most sophisticated semiconductors that we need today that are crucial to our national defense, our military industrial complex, as well as our everyday objects that we use, cars, the appliances we use, you know, manufacturing, farm equipment, and all has these sophisticated chips in it. If something happens in Taiwan, we are in trouble.
Nobody wants to think about a world where we see that kind of shortage, given our reliance on Taiwan.
No, and it certainly gets to this whole idea of onshoring and how people are looking and reevaluating their supply chains and wondering kind of where the pain points are coming out of COVID and all the different policies across the supply chain, coming out of just the overall inflationary picture and different pinpoints.
It's really an interesting dynamic, not to, you know, expand the semiconductor story to the entire economy, but it's another way in which it'll be really interesting to see what the nature of this slowdown slash potential recession looks like. Again, I mentioned about the employment side. You know, 30 years ago, coming into this business, it was the first jobless recovery. And economists were flummoxed that we had this economic recovery and it wasn't kind of creating as many jobs. The economy was changing. I wonder if you could have a version of a full employment recession where employment really doesn't erode that much for demographic and other reasons. And the fact that, but also on CapEx. I mean, are we now in a mode where longer term corporate balance sheets are okay and we simply feel like there are these longer term priorities that we have to fulfill in terms of building up capacity, because the big shock was lack of productive capacity across the world.
Did you see that op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today talking about just the fact that we don't need austerity right now and the impact that rising interest rates will have on just companies' ability to expand production? I think semiconductors is a good use case for those who are in the camp that believe that it's not the time to be raising interest rates, because you need to be encouraging companies to grow faster, further, you know, for issues, at the very least, of national security.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you hope interest rates aren't the swing factor that's going to choke that stuff off, but at some level it will. We talked about the credit markets becoming a little stingier at this point. It's very illiquid in credit trading. So there's, you know, you have to be on alert for the fact that that's kind of ratcheting in a direction of again, squeezing the capital markets in a way that we hadn't seen in the past couple of years.
We just talked about the cruise lines and the potential effect on some of those highly leveraged travel names and maybe retail. We haven't yet touched on Kohl's calling off the $8 billion sale to Franchise Group, the owner of Vitamin Shoppe. They do cut the guide. Sees Q2 sales now down high single digits. They were it down mid single digits. Yield 6.8. But you're being paid to take that kind of risk.
And they said specifically that this deal was not able to be consummated because of deteriorations in the financing markets since they initially started this process. And this has been a very, very messy process from the beginning. If you recall, they initially rejected a $64 a share bid by Starboard-backed Acacia Research, saying it was too low. Ultimately wound up going into talks with Franchise Group at about $60 per share. They lowered that to upwards of $50 per share and then ultimately couldn't consummate a deal because the retail environment over this time has deteriorated so much and they couldn't get the financing, it seems like, in order to make this happen. And so now they're doing an accelerated buyback and they say, trust us on our strategic plan. And
yeah, I mean, it's sort of shades of Nordstrom, the failed take private, you know, and they got a picky about the price point, and then they tried to have it done. You know, Kohl's itself, as much as the fundamentals are challenged and the fact that, you know, we're not in the greatest environment for that type of retailer, I mean, financially speaking, they're okay.
They're free cash flow positive.
They're fine. They have the free cash flow. I mean, you mentioned the dividend, Carl. I mean, if you had to cut it, it's $250 million a year. So it's not like they don't have options. So it's kind of just like fix the business and see where it settles out from there. As a matter of fact, what's been fascinating this for a decade is the lack of financial transactions in retail relative to what you would expect, because the stocks have been, many of the chains have been cheap forever. It seems like real estate was the backstop, and it hasn't happened because obviously because of e-commerce and because the business just changed so fast. But, you know, today you're not really seeing legs in terms of other stocks in retail getting hit by the Kohl's. I mean, Gap is up 1%, Best Buy is up. So people aren't saying that there's anything really that's informative about the rest of the sector by the fact that Kohl's is not getting this deal done.
If anything, Bed Bath & Beyond was a bigger warning sign. Obviously in a bit more of a precarious situation financially than Kohl's is as well. But to your point about the lack of consolidation, I mean, one of the key buyers, at least in the last decade, has been private equity.
Absolutely.
And private equity has gotten burned by and large in acquiring these types of assets. And so obviously you saw here with Franchise Group, that was a private equity buyer, and there were some others in the mix here as well, but they're not going to go out on the risk spectrum. And I think that's kind of reading between the tea leaves here and understanding why they rejected the inability to get financing and things like that. It's because it's a riskier deal, and private equity may have had that risk appetite to do these types of deals in the past.
Yeah.
They're paring that back because they've seen this movie before.
Yeah, that is interesting. By the way, in terms of market action at the open here, it is interesting to see some people take bets on home builders. Lennar is going to be your top gainer, and Horton is in there as well. Pulte, right behind Etsy as the market leaders at the open. I guess on the prospect of a marginal second derivative in mortgage rates. We know structurally underhoused. Lumber's come in. Maybe labor gets cheaper, right?
That's 100% right. I mean, it's a direct, you know, yield effect at this point. The 10-year at 2.88, that doesn't send the greatest message in general, but it's relief for the mortgage demand picture. So that's a big part of it. And, you know, the 2-year yield at 2.83, 2.82, it was almost a 3.5 a little while ago. So you're taking more than 3 potential rate hikes implicitly out of the 2-year horizon at this point versus what we thought a while ago. Now, I've seen some work. Piper Sandler had some work about the projected Fed funds rate in 6 months compared to in 18 months. And it's never had this sharp a decline. In other words, people are saying starting in 6 months, you're going to have peak rates. Fed's going to have to be cutting. And that tends to be a precursor to a formal recession. So that's the way the market's positioning right now, for sure.
Interesting. And you can see, you know, we talked a little bit about commodities yesterday, but there's just been this bifurcation between the metals, which are a signal of slowing economic demand, or at least investor belief that they're slowing economic demand for them. And then on the crude side of things, they are in the green today. You've got WTI now at about 108. Obviously, much higher before that. Gas prices have come down a little bit.
15% on the wholesale level. for gasoline.
Yeah. I filled up my tank, I think, at the peak, though. I try and, you know.
Yeah, you wanted
I try and game
you
it.
You wanted a top ticket?
Yeah, we have way? A hybrid. Yeah. So I'm like, if I'm filling up my tank, I want to get a good deal.
That's how you know you got the best gas, because you paid the most for it.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I know I definitely did it wrong this week.
We are coming off a losing month of crude. And as Leslie says, gasoline, you should be seeing some relief. RBOB wholesale gas prices are the lowest since middle of May. So as I said on Twitter yesterday, if your gas station doesn't start trimming price, find a new gas station. As for the laggards, though, it's a Micron halo, essentially. Lam, Research, KLA, onsemi, AMAT. And then, Mike, AMD and NVIDIA, are not, Qualcomm, Skyworks, Intel are not going to escape this idea that not just, I mean, it's not just about smartphones weakening, but PCs down 10 for the year. That's Micron's view.
Exactly, So the closer you are to that, that's going to be the biggest impact. And yeah, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that semis held up so much better for so much longer on the idea, perhaps, that there was something secular going on, that you can escape some of the gravity of a typical cycle. And it doesn't mean that's invalid at this point, but it shows you people aren't willing to pay up for the idea anymore at this point.
Yeah. Speaking of cyclicality, you saw kind of a wave of price cuts from analysts cutting prices of bank stocks this morning as well. That came out of Wells Fargo, RBC, Piper Sandler. Analysts at all of those shops just announced a whole slew of bank stock cuts. Stocks not responding too much to them, a bit lower in pre-market, but now you can see JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, you know, relatively unfazed.
We'll keep our eye, speaking of financial-related commodities, keep your eye on Bitcoin, 19.3. The market cap now, as we've said last few weeks, about a little more than $750 million. As I said, a couple of Johnson & Johnsons.
Yep.
Speaking of fire sales in retail, still looking to see some resolution on BlockFi and whether or not you're really talking about deals at pennies on the dollar.
Penny fire sales. Yeah. You know, there's the best microcosm is just looking at the performance for the first half. You know, you had Bitcoin down 60%. You had the dollar index put forth by the Wall Street Journal up 9%, one of the few gainers. And so when you look at just overall risk appetite in the market during the first half, perhaps there's you know, few things that really tell that story, like the divergence between Bitcoin and the dollar.
And it feels as if everyone is looking at it in a couple different respects. One, there obviously was a tremendous wealth effect. It was the paper wealth effect that fueled a certain kind of spending, but also another kind of speculation, right? I mean, the whole NFT boom was basically people just sort of laundering their crypto winnings in some way. But on the other piece of it is it systemic? Are there links to other parts of the financial system? Is anybody going to be caught out? What's happened to the deleveraging process? So far, it's not as if you've seen, you know, any of those holes being blown in the, you know, in the hall. So I don't know. We got to wait.
Yeah. I mean, Deutsche had a great chart yesterday looking at Fed total assets and Bitcoin.
Mm. Yeah.
And I know people argue about causation, but if that top number of Fed assets rolls over, then what happens to Bitcoin? Deutsche's view is maybe this is just beginning. Sam Bankman-Fried tonight on Crypto Night in America. Maybe we'll get more answers on the future of the asset and specifically about BlockFi in particular.
Yeah, he said at the Sohn conference a few weeks ago that he thinks that there's actually a correlation between the fact that inflation was higher than the print suggested a long time ago, and that's why you were seeing Bitcoin come down, and he thinks there is some sort of inflection point where you'll start to see it go back higher again. Kind of a different take.
Just on the Fed balance sheet thing, I mean, so the Fed balance sheet kind of hesitates at all-time highs, and crypto goes down 60%. I mean, are we really saying that there's some kind of dollar for dollar relationship in how this works? I don't know.
Yeah. It's a lot of disagreements about what Bitcoin is tracking. We are up 60 points to start the quarter. Let's get to Bob Bassani. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, guys. A bit of a flattish open, a little bit to the plus side maybe, about even on the advanced decline line. Everybody's watching the 10-year yields move to the downside. Watch the commodities. Oil's up, but copper's at a new low today, and the DBB, that metals ETF that I watch, also 52-week low. Take a look at these sectors. Of course, energy was the big winner in the first half, still up today. Consumer staples strong. Those discretionaries are doing well. Guys mentioned the home builders. They're all nicely helping the S&P 500 there. There's your semiconductor index. No surprise there after the Micron comments. We got a lot of new lows in semiconductors today, led by Micron, of course, you heard. weakening consumer demands. They're talking about hurting cell phone sales. But we got new lows in NVIDIA, Lam Research, Advanced Micro as well. So we'll keep an eye on that. For the second half, well, there's two obvious issues here that we're dealing with. One is this whole pivot from inflation to whether or not we have a soft landing or recession. And that's the dividing line right there, that slash. What side of the debate are you on? And then, of course, everyone has been waiting for these downward revisions to earnings estimates we talk about endlessly. I just want to show you the estimates are still quite high. And the only reason they're this high is because the oil companies are moving the numbers. But for Q3, we're still looking at estimates of about 11%. And for Q4, still almost 11%. These are actually higher than they were on April 1st. So they're not overall reducing the numbers. And again, the only reason they're this high is because the energy companies are pushing these estimates up rather noticeably. So we've got this 10% increase in earnings. And a lot of the top-down strategists are saying, well, you know, we might not be able to do that. The S&P could have another 10% down. And that's how you get to 3,400, where a lot of people, a lot of strategists have been talking about. Want to update you on the second half of the year on the IPO picture. Could it be any worse? I've been covering IPOs for 25 years. I can't remember a collapse like this. We had 21 IPOs in the second quarter that raised $2.1 billion. Is that a little, a lot? Well, in the second quarter of 2021, it was much more normal. We had 118 IPOs raising $40 billion. That's a 95% collapse year over year. You don't have that very often. We had that in 2008, 2009. We had it in 2002. But again, those were after really big down years. So this is one of the worst starts to IPOs in a long, long time. So what's up? Well, there's three main points here. Everybody knows here. Number one is market volatility. That's the major headwind. When you get the VIX over 25 consistently, it's a major, major problem for the markets overall. That's a big, big issue. So the problem here is we've got to get the VIX down. Then you have lower potential valuations. And poor aftermarket performance. How poor has the performance been? Lousy. We only have 11% of the IPOs trading above their issuance prices that went public last year. 11%. Typically, you get 50, 60%. That tells people who are going public saying, holy cow, we can't go public with that, the numbers down like that. It's a real emotional and intellectual headwind for people who are looking to go public out there. There's a lot of great companies, though, just sitting on the sidelines, waiting to go public. One of the big ones is Mobileye. That's, of course, Intel's big self-driving vehicle technology company. And we've got Arm, a huge chip designer that's sitting out there. Instacart's been waiting for a long time. That's a big grocery delivery platform. We've got Discord. That's the big platform. It's really popular with the gamers. It's a voice chat service. That could have a $10 billion plus valuation sitting out there. And there's other ones that are out there. Reddit is there, the big social media platform. There's a potential one. And Travelport, a distribution platform for the travel industry. So Carl and Leslie and Mike, there's no shortage of potential companies that are sitting out there. But in this kind of environment, when the valuations are under pressure and when you've got enormous volatility, it's very difficult to make any argument right now to go public. Guys, back to you.
All right, Bob, thanks. We'll see you in a bit. Bob Pisani. Still to come this morning, don't miss our exclusive interview with the owner of the Dallas Cowboys and oil billionaire Jerry Jones, more than doubling his $1 billion investment in natural gas, which, by the way, fell below the 200-day yesterday for the first time since February. Back above it this morning. As we go to break, let's get a look at the bond report. We've talked about declining yields for most of the morning. There's that 10-year at 287 and the long bond at 309. Dow's up 160. We're back in a minute. Even though we've switched over to a new quarter, take a look at the gainers for the week. General Mills, best week since March. One of the names that Cramer suggested as being recession-proof, followed by a lot of energy names. Hess, Valero's in there, some defense, and actually home builders catching up a bit week to date, given today's price action. Dow's up 133. Squawk on the Street continues after a short break.
Chinese President Xi Jinping speaking in Hong Kong today, celebrating the 25th anniversary of the city's handover from Britain. Our Eunice Yuna is live from Beijing with the latest. Eunice, what's the reaction been like there?
Well, Leslie, the reaction has been positive, especially in the state media, as you would imagine. And also on social media, there's been a lot of discussion about the 25th anniversary. In fact, the hashtag about it got more than 1.5 billion views, all praising the fact that President Xi was there and the fact that Hong Kong has been returned to China in the past 25 years. So the other significant event here is that this was President Xi's first trip outside of the mainland since the start of the pandemic nearly 900 days ago. He took a special train across the border to Hong Kong, where he swore in the new chief executive, John Lee, who is seen as a hardliner who had overseen the crackdown on protesters in 2019. President Xi also addressed a lot of the concerns that the business community has had, both the business community within Hong Kong as well as outside, saying that Beijing was committed to supporting Hong Kong's role as an international hub, expanding linkages with the world, and promoting markets and development. At the same time, he repeated positions towards Hong Kong, though, that have been worrying some of the business community, Carl, such as the need to restore order from chaos.
What a remarkable week in China this week. Eunice, thank you. Eunice Yun in Beijing this morning. After the break, we're going to check in with Art Cashin, talk about how to best play the second half of trading of the year, which is now officially underway at 3807. We're back in two. You've been listening to The Opening Bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.